The Kinship of Catholics and Jews is a program sponsored by the Institute of Judeo-Christian Studies at Seton Hall University. I'm Father Lawrence Frizzell. I'm the director of the Institute and moderator of this program. With me today is Bishop Brian Farrell, who is a longtime officer in the Holy See in Rome, in the Vatican in Rome. And since 2003, he has been the secretary, that is the person with Cardinal Koch. He is the person in charge of Catholic-Jewish relations, yes, as the subcommission for religious relations with the Jews, and also with the Council for Promoting Christian Unity, which is now called the Dicastery for Promoting Christian Unity. So I welcome you, Bishop Farrell.
Thank you.
And
thank
you. Yesterday you gave a very fine presentation for the university, and I would like to follow that pattern of reflecting with you on the way in which the Church has developed in the search for internal unity among Christians. The search for unity is a very challenging aspect of your work, and I would like to have you share with us the various dialogues that have been developing over the past 60-some years, and especially since you came at the beginning of the new millennium to your office as secretary for the Dicastery for Promoting Christian Unity. So, Bishop Farrell, you had discussed the very ancient churches in the Middle East and in other areas, what would be beyond, in some places, beyond the boundaries of the Roman Empire. And tell us a little bit about some of those communities.
Yes, well, of course, people would wonder which churches they are, because here in the West we don't have so many of them present, or if we do, they're a very small minority, and people don't often have an opportunity to meet them. But these are extraordinarily important churches from the very first centuries of Christianity. They grew up, if you wish, after the work of the first apostolic age and into the first, second, and third centuries. They grew up at the edge of the Roman Empire, or even outside the Roman Empire. And these are the churches of the Armenian tradition, the Syriac tradition, or the Coptic tradition in Egypt and Ethiopia and so forth. So these churches, and the bottom line is that it is clear that when we can recognize that they have continued in apostolic succession, in other words, they can connect themselves back to the very time of the apostles and afterwards, Catholics have a particularly close relationship with them. And these churches, on the other hand, down the centuries have been very often the objects of much persecution and great suffering. And even today, many of them live in areas that are quite in conflict, like in Syria, Iraq, or even in parts of Africa and so forth. So with these churches, we have begun in 2003, all of them together as a kind of family, we have begun a very interesting conversation, if you want to call it, a dialogue. And down the years, we have clarified all the things that we have in common. Even after 1,500 years of separation, we have so much in common. We recognize their priesthood, they recognize our priesthood, our sacraments, so that there's very little that divides us. Naturally, we are very culturally very different. We Catholics here in the West, we're very different culturally. We have different traditions, different ways of celebrating, for example. But we, theologically, we are on the same wavelength about these things. So this dialogue continues to build closeness and cooperation. For example, it's very important in places like the Middle East and so forth, where you have Catholics and Orthodox living side by side, very often in the same family, in the same village, in the same town, that they accept each other to collaborate and help each other and work together and try to develop the well-being of the whole Christian community in difficult situations. So this is one of those dialogues, connections, that I really think we should be very grateful for and that we will continue to develop into the future.
And so these groups, of course, have their own language, and usually it's a very ancient language in which they pray. And and as you say, we can resonate very well with the content of their spirituality and of their liturgy. So it's wonderful that this development has been taking place, and I certainly wish you great success as you continue to explore the ways in which Christian unity can be fostered in these areas where there has been indeed much suffering and persecution on the part of these minority Christians.
Yeah. But let me point out, Father Larry, that this is the work of many people altogether. It's, you know, many experts in the history of the churches, in the theology of the churches. It's not just a small group of us that work from Rome. We help to organize it all, and we take part in it. But we are so grateful for the help of theologians in all many different countries, including the U.S., who help us in these conversations.
Sure. And so that's very important, to have the scholarly foundation in terms of knowing the texts and appreciating the values that are being presented in the spirituality of many communities.
Yes, yeah.
Now, the second group that you mentioned, of course, would be the Christian Orthodox communities that are associated with Constantinople, where the patriarch lives in to this day, lives in Istanbul, and of course these churches of the East have their own great deep history and number of enormous challenges. Mm. So tell us about the work that you've been doing with regard to the churches of the Byzantine tradition.
All right. Very good. Well, the Byzantine tradition is probably better known to most of our listeners in the sense that they are more present here, for example, in the United States. But the background is so interesting. For 1,000 years, East and West were united in one church. I mean, each part of it developed its own ways, its own liturgy, its own use of language and so forth. In the East, the Greek language, in the West, the Latin language, and then later the national languages that developed in Europe. But the point is this, that at a certain point, the tensions between East and West, which were not overly religious, they were more political and question of conquest and development of empires and so forth. It came to a head in the year 1054 when Rome excommunicated Constantinople and Constantinople excommunicated Rome. And this gave a beginning to a rift that down the centuries has grown ever wider, both culturally and theologically and so forth. So the fact is that we had for so long the awareness, the consciousness of living in the same church. Now what we're trying to do is in dialogue with the Byzantine Orthodox to clarify the theological reasons and the non-theological reasons why we remain separate, and to try to overcome them into the future. So, at the end of the day, we agree with the Orthodox in practically everything that has to do with the Christian life and spirituality and so forth. They have their form of liturgy, we have ours, but we recognize that that is a valid way of celebrating the Eucharist, for example, and the other sacraments and so on. So in that sense, we are very, very close to them. But there is a problem with the exercise of authority in the Church. Who has the last word, in a sense? And naturally, for Catholics, everybody understands that the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, is the first teacher in the Church and the first governor in the Church, with, naturally, the help of all the other bishops and so forth. The East will find that very difficult because they have lived 1,000 years separated from that kind of authority. Our conversations, for the last 20 years, have been around this question. How is teaching authority and governance organized in a united Church? When we get back together, please God, one day, because the Lord really wants that, how will it be exercised? So we're in deep theological discussion about these things, and let me say that we are making a great deal of progress. Everybody recognizes that the Bishop of Rome is the first bishop. The question is, what kind of authority does he exercise? And of course we say, well, he's not going to interfere with the internal life of these churches that have their own ways of doing things, their own traditions, their own values, their own spirituality, and have lived down the centuries with that and have produced great saints and great scholars and great signs of fidelity to the Lord. So we are in the process, to put it simply, of finding a way to combine the question of authority with the question of the respectful independence, you might say, of each of these different ways of being Christian. That may sound complicated. Well, it is a bit complicated. It's a very deep and difficult study and discussion. But once again, I have to say, we do make progress. We are making progress. And into the future, please God, the Lord will give us the strength to continue this path and give us the intelligence and the heart to find a much closer relationship. We look forward to that. Now, if you ask me how we stand at this present moment, well, there are a number of new difficulties, if you wish, in the sense that the situation in Eastern Europe creates tensions between one part of the Orthodox world and the other, makes it difficult for the dialogue to produce good results. But nevertheless, we pray every day and hope that once this war is over, that we will be in a position to continue to walk together to find someday the unity that the Lord prayed for at the Last Supper.
And this walking together draws our attention to the development of the idea of solidarity in relating to synodality. Mm-hmm. And so could you explain to our listeners something about this process of development, the concept of synodality is crucial?
Right. Well, let me put it in very simple terms. It may be by putting it in too simple terms, sometimes we don't give the exact picture, but it's like this. The Church is a body, and it's not supposed to be a body in which only one person is above everybody else in the sense of authority and command. So from the very beginning, the bishops worked in communion and in what we called a synod. And a synod is when the bishops get together and they know who is the first of them, who is in charge. So that the old ancient law, the apostolic tradition, is that the bishops should do nothing unless the head is in agreement. And the head should do nothing without consulting the body of the bishops. Now, sometimes down the course of history, the balance here has been lost. So when you hear about the synodal process in the church, what it really is an effort to bring back a proper balance between the first of the bishops and the rest of the body of them as they try to lead the church to along the path that the Lord wants. So it's a kind of correction, if you wish, of the way we have been developing in the last centuries. And today, this is one of the great challenges of our Catholic Church, to reacquire that proper balance. So let me point out that the Orthodox churches in the East have maintained that kind of synodal structure down the centuries when we were kind of losing it or weakening it. So now we're being helped by them to find ways to, as I said, rediscover that proper balance that we need.
And of course, this is a process that can involve every part of the church, and yes. So we've had these local synods, gatherings of people, the faithful in general, and the clergy,
yes.
to intensify yeah. and to deepen our appreciation of how we are to work together, and as you say, to walk together,
yes.
In the pilgrimage of life.
Uh-huh.
So these developments, of course, with the tragedy of war disrupting many things, we keep praying for the peace that will allow Christian communities to develop more profoundly in their relationship with each other.
Yes.
And indeed, we hope for that political peace that will allow for the development of the spiritual
exactly.
Search for unity. Now, the other groups, of course, are the ones we're most familiar with in terms of people living in the United States. So tell us a little bit about the way in which Christian ecumenism, that is, a search for unity and for understanding each other, has been developing in the churches of Europe and the yeah. Americas.
Well, let me put it this way. Our relationship with the Protestant world, let's say, between Catholics and Protestants, is also a very important success story. They tell the story that when Pope John the 23rd decided to call the Ecumenical Council, the Second Vatican Council, one day he was with some of his helpers and advisors, and he said to them, "And by the way, I would like to invite observers from the other churches to come to the council." And they kind of stopped and said, "Well, we don't even talk to them. How can we do this?" So they had to find a way to come into contact with these churches that had ignored each other for so long after the time of the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation. So eventually there was a great group of observers, friends from the other churches who came to the Second Vatican Council. And since then, we have engaged with practically all forms of Christian churches in this effort to create a much better relationship and to develop a theological understanding of the differences between us, which of them are real, which of them are merely the result of the way we painted each other down the centuries. And I must say too here that things have changed so much in the last 60 years since that time that John the 23rd opened up the Catholic Church to what we call the ecumenical movement. So we have to be very grateful that things are very different. We work together, we walk together, we collaborate, we meet challenges together in so many different ways. So this is another success story of the ecumenical movement.
And we're, of course, seeing that the variety of dialogues has certainly stimulated considerable interest. And so tell us a little bit about the dialogue, let's say, with the Anglican Church and the Episcopal Church here in the United States.
All right. Well, of course, we have, from the late 60s, we have a formal dialogue, theological dialogue, with the Anglican Communion in its different provinces around the world. So this is a very, on the one side, I would say it's an easy, because culturally we are living in the same world, we understand each other. But theologically, we have very important differences that have developed since the time of Henry VIII and so forth. And it's not easy to find a way to overcome these very profound differences. But the very fact that we are working on it and that we are talking to each other and that we are working together in many local different ways is hugely important. We have, down the years, had some very interesting, from the theological point of view, interesting agreements about matters of Christian faith and life and so on. At the moment, the dialogue is facing a big challenge, which is to try to deal somehow with the fact that in many ways we have different approaches to the sacraments on the one hand, but also to the ethical questions of life, marriage, and so forth. The dialogue is productive in the sense that it brings us into a new climate of collaboration and solidarity and so forth with Anglicans around the world. But it is also very difficult in the sense that there are always clear differences that we have not yet been able to overcome.
And I would like you to explore with us the recent visit of Pope Francis and the Archbishop of Canterbury and the President of the Presbyterian Church to the area of South Sudan, known now the new country, Sudan, which has had so many problems recently.
Okay. Well, I think it's very easy to understand if you see what happened in history. So missionaries from different churches came to that area of Africa about 150 years ago. What happened then was that each church developed its mission in a different area with different tribes and peoples. So down the years, each church developed in a different part. Recently, in the last decade and so forth, there has been struggle and conflict and violence between the tribes and the peoples there. And they are also separated by the fact that they belong to different churches. They are not fighting because they belong to the different churches, but they are distinguished by that. And so the idea came that the heads of the principal churches there, the Anglican Communion, the Presbyterian, and the Catholics, the heads, the Pope, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the moderator of the Church of Scotland, they would all come together just to show that Christians should be standing together and not fighting one another. This was the background to the visit. Now, the visit was prepared in the past by, for example, the political leaders of South Sudan came to Rome, met the Pope, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the moderator of the Church of Scotland in a retreat. They prayed together, seeking peace. The peace comes and goes, but it needed this impulse of the visit to settle it.
So that very practical initiative certainly has, we hope, continued to bear fruit, and we'll keep that in our prayers.
Right.
Bishop Farrell, I wish to thank you very much for joining me today for the Kinship of Catholics and Jews. We wish you a safe trip back home to Rome, and many blessings for your work in the future.
Thank you.
And we invite our listeners to be with us again next Sunday at 11 a.m. for the Kinship of Catholics and Jews.
Thank you. Thank you, Father.